Welcome to the next step. The next step is figuratively, but also literally in this case, what happens after the first time. It's about figuring out what to do next in life, specifically how to manage the push-pull between ambition and contentment. Like, what do you have to do to achieve the things you want, and how can you be happy if you achieve nothing? Sometimes I wonder, would I be better off spending my time setting goals and making lists or meditating? Perhaps I should do a vision board. How do people make money and grow successful multi-million dollar businesses? Like, what are the actual steps? And are ice baths the answer to everything? I'm Catherine Collette, and this is The Next Step. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Laurie Kilmartin is a stand-up comedian and an Emmy-nominated and award-winning comedy writer. She was a staff writer for all 11 years of Conan and has performed stand-up on Conan, The Late Late Show with James Corden and Comedy Central. Laurie Kilmartin is also on Twitter. A lot of people are on Twitter and have been on Twitter, but she is the kind of tweeter that makes you wish Twitter was still a thing. For example, she live tweeted her dad's death. This might sound strange, but if you have read the tweets related to this, they are both heart-wrenching and actually hilarious. She is very, very funny. Laurie has done a lot of cool stuff, and she's super candid in this episode about the reality of being a comedian. Her newest special is called Cis Woke Grief Slut. It's currently available. I'll link to where to find it in Australia. I'll also link to the comedy transitions that we discuss and to some of her tweets because they really are hilarious. I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. Welcome, Laurie Kilmartin, to The Next Step.
Thank you, Catherine. I'm very excited to be here.
Laurie, we are always super interested in origin stories on this show. How, when, where did your love of comedy begin?
I guess for me, it would start with Carol Burnett. Her show was on Saturday nights in the US, and I'd watch it with my mom, my sister and I would. And I think those were the deepest belly gut laughs I remember my mom ever producing. And I guess I just always wanted to be able to do that, you know? So very, very early on, I just wanted to get those Carol Burnett-like laughs.
Was there a particular moment that you decided, rather than just sitting and being a person in the audience, that you'd actually get up on stage yourself?
I had wanted to be an actress as growing up because I guess that's what Carol Burnett was. And there wasn't like a huge stand-up industry like there is now. So there wasn't anyone where I looked to and thought, oh, I could be like that person. But I do remember going to see a lot of stand-up in San Francisco in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, and being kind of overwhelmed by the great stand-up, but also I saw some people that weren't that funny getting, you know, work and showing up repeatedly at all these shows I'd go to. And I was like, oh, all right, you don't have to be great be a comedian. So I could do that. Like this, a couple of like really average comics lowered the bar enough for me to think that I could do it.
I think that is completely underestimated as like the most motivating thing in the world. It's not like successful people who are inspirational. It's actually people who are not that good.
Yeah. I mean, that's the same thing with my first writing job was on a show where there was someone who was a couple of people that were hired out. And I was like, I know that person hasn't written a joke in 20 years. There's no way, you know, and then I had to reorient my opinion on what a writer was. Like, sometimes they're friends of somebody, you know? And so it's like, oh, okay. If it's not, you know, that you had to graduate from Harvard and be a dude or, you know, all these things that it seemed like it was, then maybe there's room for me. So, I mean, sadly, I was more inspired by people that I didn't think were as, you know, that weren't that inspirational.
You said in an interview that it's a generalization, but I think guys get on stage to get laid and women get on stage to get heard. For female comics, it's such a personal thing. I hardly know any female stand-ups who talk about generic stuff. It's always really what happened to you. In your early days of doing stand-up, what stories or experiences did you want to be heard?
I don't remember like a specific thing, or there was almost things I couldn't talk about because they were too personal. So I would talk around them. And I know when I first started, it was more just trying to get like people, like I was really shy, you know, I was quiet in high school and I wasn't like the class clown. And so it was more just like trying to get people to pay attention and listen and like command the audience. You have to be like a little general in charge of an army when you're a stand-up, you know? And I think for the first, you know, at least 5 years, I was just getting used to people looking at me on stage and being looked at and being comfortable in my body. And, you know, whatever jokes I told, it were kind of like just reflective of, you know, the level of depth I had at that time as a 25 or 26 year old, which wasn't much, you know, just hadn't done much. And the things I had done, I hadn't processed very well. That would come later through therapy. So, so that felt like more of a female survival, you know, just being on stage as a woman and trying to make sure people were listening to what I was saying and controlling the responses to me. If that makes sense.
I think that's something we'll come back to later. But first, I want to talk about different types of comedy writing. You wrote for Conan O'Brien for 11 years as a monologue writer. We've got a pretty varied audience for this podcast. So maybe firstly, for those that don't know, what is a monologue writer?
The jokes that a US host does at the beginning of the show that are almost always topical, stuff that's based off the news that day. Conan had a very classic style. It was very Carson-esque, where he had like a one sentence setup. The setup was always true, although we would, you know, take or add, delete details or add them depending on how they help the punchline. And then the punchline is the second sentence. And that was, you know, either silly or, you know, smart or goofy or insane, but it was always hopefully designed to get a laugh.
It's interesting you talk about the setup of those jokes, because I want to talk about a lot of your tweets. And one of the tweets that I had pulled out to talk about, which has actually been deleted, so I can't find it, but I have heard about it. Is this?
It must have got me in trouble.
No, I think, I'm not sure why. It'd be interesting to know. Maybe you'll be familiar when I say what it was. It was a tweet that you tweeted all of the transitions that you used in monologue writing. Do you remember this kind of list?
Oh, I do. I think I went through and just deleted a ton of tweets from like that were over 5 years old, just because a lot of them were topical jokes and they just look so lame. And topical jokes last like about a week and then they just look just embarrassing, you know? So I just wanted to cut everything out and start, you know, and not have 10,000 tweets up there. I made a list of, I just kept this list for myself, mostly because we would start out at the top, you know, beginning of the day with a bunch of news stories that are fresh to you in your head, and they all have potential and they all pop a little bit and you're excited. And then by the end of the day, the news cycle doesn't really change that much in the, you know, like by 4 PM, 3 PM, it's kind of the same stories as that you had at 9 AM, except you're tired of them. You've already tried 3 different jokes on this topic and they weren't picked or they weren't good enough. And you're like, so the transitions list was, I just kept compiling a list of those little things that you would say to get from the setup to the punchline. And they were just little ways to turn your brain around a teeny, teeny bit, sometimes just like a degree, and would lead you down a different path to come up with a different joke, hopefully. And I mostly turned to that. I definitely thought of it as a crutch that I would turn to when I was desperate. when, you know, we were really short of jokes, shy of a full monologue, and the news stories sucked and nothing was, you know, things were depressing or something. It's like, all right, let me pull out this list and start just reading the setup with the transition and seeing if anything popped and just kind of go down, you know, down
the can you think of any transition examples off the top of your head?
Let's see, in keeping with, or sometimes it's just little words. However, you know, to be fair, seems like a popular one that I think has been overused a lot on Twitter. Not helping, just anything that takes the subject of the sentence in a different direction and kind of helps you get to the punchline.
I love that.
I have the transitions list. I have it somewhere on my computer, but I don't have it pulled up right now. Otherwise I just rattle them off to you, but I didn't write them all. Like I wrote some of them, some of the other writers on Conan did. And then other, you know, whenever I would hear one of in a monologue, you know, I would write it down. It's they're, you know, they're fair use, you know, they're just, they're not jokes. They're just like little, you know, kind of phrases that we use in everyday life that, you know, also help switch a punchline around.
I often think it would be useful to have a similar type thing, like just a list of segues for interview questions, because that movement of one thing to another is a more difficult thing than it seems on the surface. Like the structure of having ideas that can transition you is actually a very useful one.
I agree. I don't know why I couldn't think of the word segue, but that's exactly what it was. Yeah, segues.
So monologue writing feels like it is very structured because you are working towards a pretty strict and fixed deadline. In terms of developing a stand-up set for your own kind of stand-up comedy act, where does the writing of that begin?
Often in the shower or on a long drive. Sometimes it's right before you go up on stage. Like I'll be sitting in the back of the room and there's other comics and I'm going up soon. And I start going over my set list and I'm like, oh, I need something right here. This setup is too long or whatever. Then I'll start. But it's usually, it's very different from monologue writing where you sit down in front of a Word doc at 9:30 in the morning and just start pounding them out. But it's also very personal, stand-up, super personal. So it doesn't reside in the same part of my brain as writing topical jokes that are sort of dead within a day, you know, like. If you're writing a stand-up set, you know, ideally it's not, you know, close to evergreen or something because it's about your life. Maybe the references will be too topical for it to be evergreen, but, you know, it should have a much longer shelf life than a topical joke.
And where do the jokes live while you're working them out or trying to refine them? Are they just in your head?
No, I have a bajillion. I usually get a Moleskine notebook. I have a larger one than, like, I know a lot of guys use those they use smaller little books that can fit in a pocket. And I think female comics, what I've noticed is we tend to use larger Moleskines that fit in a purse. So, I have, you know, I'm always excited to get a new Moleskine. I try to get it. I don't do the same color back to back. So that it feels like new thoughts and stuff like that. And that's where it all lives. I mean, you know, there'll be one chunk of material that will be rewritten over like three or four Moleskines. And, you know, sometimes it takes a really long time to work out a couple of minutes of jokes.
And you keep them all?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I mean, it'll be something for my son to burn after I die. But at the moment, you know, it's like thing of, oh, what if I need it? I don't know why, because my cursive is so bad. I can barely read it, you know, within 6 months, but to even be able to read like 10-year-old cursive writing of your own, it's hard, you know, like your writing changes too over the years. So yeah, I guess I haven't thrown them away yet. I mean, they won't be wanted by anyone. So, you know, it's just a chore that my loved ones will have to take care of.
I kind of think the opposite in some ways. It's sort of an extraordinary resource to see how thinking evolves around a very specific thing, how a thought is refined in a humorous way.
It is if you want to do that detective work. I mean, I don't know who would want to, but okay, you're more than welcome to.
Yeah, that is true. I mentioned Twitter before. I feel like I considered setting up this whole interview and just framing it around tweets, your tweets, and asking you to elaborate on them. You tweet a lot and your tweets are fantastic. We've talked about one of them already. In talking about tweeting, it would be difficult not to mention the fact that in 2014 you tweeted your father's death. I'm going to include some example tweets for listeners. So one is, just wail dad for 5 minutes straight. Would not be surprised if he shuffled off this myrtle coil just to get away from me. Another is, dad unknowingly unleashed a lifetime of nightmares on his seven-year-old grandson with these last words, I'll see you sooner than you think. What drove you to live tweet these moments?
When my dad was dying, he came home to die. He did home hospice. He had cancer. And so I went home. And normally when I would go, you know, I just go up on stage most nights of the week. And normally I would have just gone up and done little local shows nearby. We were back in the Bay Area where I was from. But because I thought he was, you know, he was dying. I didn't know when he would die. I didn't want to like go off, do a set and then come home and have missed it. So I decided just to stay home that forever, however long he was still with us, just to not leave the house really. And then I just started writing jokes, and I tweeted jokes before. So I just started doing it, you know, stuff I probably would have saved for an open mic that night. I just started tweeting instead. And then Patton Oswalt retweeted it and a couple other people did. And then people started paying attention, and it ended up being this really weird thing where a lot of people were following my dad's journey through me. And then, for my dad was like a pretty hardcore Catholic, and you know, we were able to tell him all these strangers are praying for you. So he wasn't involved in Twitter, you know, and obviously at that stage of your life, you're not thinking about anything like that. But I think he was comforted by, you know, people saying they were praying for him. So yeah.
There's something really beautiful about bearing witness, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird way to have your death recorded, I'm sure. But, you know, but also it's my experience of a death, and, you know, his death is his own thing. And however he experienced it was his thing. I was experiencing as a daughter, and that, you know, that was the first time I had, you know, that was my first loss of a parent. My mom was still alive at the time. And all, you know, all the feelings that go through that, when you go through all that, is they're, you know, they're so common, but they're, when they happen to you, they're extremely unique and you can't believe it. So yeah.
Quite blindsiding. We talked before about the early stages of your career and sort of getting used to being up on stage. Another tweet: it's so wild to me that there are comedians who started their careers with sold-out shows. Most comics, including me, believe it takes at least 10 years to find your comedic voice on stage. Part of the process is performing for strangers that you need to win over. How do you do that in front of crowds that already love you? I have no answers. It's just a comment. I'm really curious about this idea of, I guess from the outside, you think learning the art of stand-up comedy is about learning to tell jokes, but this crowd element that it sounds like it can't be underestimated. What's the hardest type of crowd to win over, and how do you win them over?
Oh, for me, it was the women aren't funny crowd, which is, you know, especially when, I don't know when that article came out, sometime in the 90s with that Vanity Fair, Christopher Hitchens article, but that made it really hard. And you just had to, like, you could talk to a ton of female comics in my generation. We start hard with jokes and we keep slamming for at least 5 minutes until it's like, all right, you guys good? Can I breathe for a second and grow a little bit? Or do I have to keep it? You know, we were all sort of trained like that. Like, if you know, the guys were able to just kind of wander mentally on stage and they didn't have to convince the audience their gender was funny. So they had a different experience. I remember, oh my God, watching, did a bunch of comedy competitions when I was younger, because that was like a way to get seen. And just watching the difference of when a guy would take the stage and a woman would take the stage, you could see the audience be like, oh, like the women in the audience were like, please don't suck. You know, I'm going to have to defend you on the way home if you suck. Please don't suck. And the men like, oh,
wow.
And so you just, it's just a different approach to the audience. And I don't think the women starting now have that exact experience because there's so many funny female comics that you can't even make that argument anymore. You sound like an incel if you say women aren't funny. But back in the 90s, it was like, you're just a regular dude. You're Jerry Lewis, you know? So yeah, it's definitely different now. And the audience is really different. The audience also doesn't believe that anymore. So you don't have to overcome that with the audience, really. Like if you have that sense from that audience, you're talking to like, I don't know, radio DJs or something, you know what I mean? It's not like a contemporary audience. So I forget the question you asked me.
No, just about what is the hardest type of crowd to win over? I think you've answered it.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. And I guess with that tweet, which I feel like people kind of misunderstood, but part of finding your comedic voice is that you're performing in front of strangers who are in various levels of resistance to you. Some of them are excited. They're at the comedy show. Sometimes they were dragged there, whatever, but they don't know you. And you've already committed to making them laugh. So part of, you know, there's a lot of, you know, resistance to that sometimes, right? And so you developing a persona that can overcome that is really important. And that's your comedy persona, basically, at some point. And you find out how to do it by having crowds that don't like you all of a sudden, that want to make you like them, that want you to work. And I think if you're like, that's what I guess I was talking about, like, people that come right from TikTok and get super famous on TikTok or Instagram and then go to headlining comedy clubs and selling them out. It's like, well, how can you tell what's funny? Because they're just excited to see you because you're the guy from TikTok. So the laughs are, you know, I think if you're like a comic and all of a sudden you blow up, you know the difference between a laugh at a good joke and a laugh because you're that person they saw from that thing. You can tell. Right. And so, you know, that might not be a great joke. You know, I may be getting that laugh because they're just excited to see me. And you can, and then you can like either get rid of the joke because, you know, it's really not over time going to represent you very well, or you just, I don't know, however you handle it. But I don't think you can, you know, you're able to develop that ability to hear a different kind of laugh if you're always hearing like screams when you go up on stage. You know what I mean?
I do that. The audience is almost too generous in one case.
Way too generous. I mean, like if you like Chris Rock, I think I don't know him, but I think he's always said like the first 5 minutes, you know, being famous buys you something for the first 5 minutes, but then you have to work. But he knows the difference because he wasn't famous his whole life. Like he knows. I don't know. I think if you can't tell the difference because you didn't have to go through that, that kind of, unknown part of performing, it's impossible to get it afterwards.
Sort of on this topic of reception of jokes, another tweet, is there a way to become successful in this business without nodding when Joe Rogan says stupid shit or being squeaky clean? For those that aren't familiar with Joe Rogan, what is the choice here? Like, what are the options?
I don't know. All I know is I've seen friends of mine or comics I like go on a show and it benefits them financially on levels I can't even imagine. Just go, And when he starts saying the crazy stuff and I'm like, oh my God, why are you doing this? But I mean, they have, you know, their mortgages are paid off. So I know why they're doing it. You know, or they're whatever they're selling out shows. It's just funny to see what people do to promote their stuff. Cause we all have a line where we're like, I don't think so. But it's like, oh, that's not your line. Oh, interesting. All right. I thought you'd have that would be your line. The guy that promoted, Alex Jones, since you have kids. All right. Okay. That's weird. Interesting. But I don't know. I don't know everyone's inner work, everyone's journey, everyone's financial struggles. Who knows? I don't know. It just always cracks me up when I see people I know have common sense just sit there and, like you could see them painfully hoping this, the rant that they're listening to dies down.
The, I mean, at the other end of the spectrum, squeaky clean comedy, it's wild to me what subgenres can exist. In an interview, and I can't remember where it was, you mentioned the Christian comedy circuit.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I'm just, I am, you know, an atheist. I'm not on any Christian circuit. They're making so much money. And I mean, I'm just like, good for you. That's cool. Like, we should all be able to find our audiences, you know, and there's a huge market for very clean material, which again is great. I'm not a clean comic. And when I try to be clean, it doesn't feel natural. So it's like, that's not me. So I guess sometimes it's just like, oh, is there room for us dark, sarcastic, nasty comics that are totally filthy? I don't know, whatever. I'm just complaining on Twitter, you know.
No, I like it.
And totally, if you, you know, I know some brilliant clean comics and they should be making as much money as they can. You know what I mean? It's really cool that there are all these different markets for comedy. And that's how popular stand-up comedy is. And I just wish there was one more market. Called the Laurie Kilmartin market.
Yeah, would be great. The clean comedy is achievement. It's also like just positive comedy or comedy that is celebratory can be quite hard to do, I think.
Yeah.
Comedy definitely can be about criticism, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it is for me, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to be a good comic no matter what your style is, you know, and especially hard to keep the career going for a long time. So anyone that just keeps the ball in the air and has figured out their style and figured out what they do best and then knows how to make a living at it, it's really, you know, cheers, hats off, all that kind of stuff.
Part of what underlies that choice, Joe Rogan, squeaky clean comedy and all the rest of it, or related to that perhaps, is cancel culture, if you say the wrong thing, kind of frightening because it can impact on a person's livelihood, but also the level of aggression that can sit behind cancel culture. You had a pretty bad experience in the aftermath of telling an abortion joke. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you took from that experience? Did it change what you're willing to say?
No, it didn't. I was on, we have a cable network here called MSNBC, which is, portrayed as left wing, but they're all, in my opinion, they're all right wing, but some are less than others. But I just did one of their shows on a Sunday night, which had very low viewership. It was Mother's Day weekend, Sunday. So no one was watching hard news on Mother's Day evening. And it was the weekend that in the States they'd leaked a draft that the Supreme Court was going to overturn Roe v. Wade, which is our, you know, abortion, basically our right to have an abortion. And so I just made a joke about it. And the joke got, like, no one said anything to me Sunday night. I got no emails. I got no indication that anyone watched. And I was like, shrug. Okay, whatever. I put on makeup for nothing because, you know, we had to Zoom it in. Some right wing like Facebook, YouTube shows started posting it and commenting on it, and you know, basically made it seem like all Democrats would love to abort Republican babies. And it was just, and then it just turned into like 3 days of death threats and I know where you live. And I was, Sean Hannity, this blowhard on Fox News, did a segment on me with the guests. These three people were talking about me: Lara Trump, who's the wife of Eric Trump, who's the son of Donald Trump, and Pam Bondi, who's this just craven former attorney general of Florida who did not prosecute Trump for the fraud he committed with his university, which kind of basically gave him the ability to run for president, et cetera. We all know how that turned out. Anyway, a bunch of MAGA hacks were discussing me on national television, which was really strange too. So that was like,
so what do you do?
Oh,
what do you do in that situation? Like, do you go into hiding? Do you?
No. I had shows, and for a couple of days, people were highly aware of it. And then it just died down. And I realized, so they're like little wasps that run around and they attack a target and then they get directed to something else. I mean, just like monologue jokes don't have a huge lifespan. So these little stories don't either. But when you're the subject of one, it feels like, you know, someone's going to come to your house and slit your throat. But, you know. So it was very intense, and then it went away. And then I just started writing jokes about it. So it turned out to be something in my act.
Just kind of the best revenge, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah.
non-tweeting things now. Making a career or having longevity in any kind of creative industry, be it writing, comedy, whatever, it is not easy to do. I'm curious about how people plan for the career or the life that they want. Some people use vision boards, affirmations, manifesting. Others just do spreadsheets and goal setting. Others do nothing. How consciously do you think about what you want or what you want to achieve in life?
I'm very non-organized with that kind of stuff. I did go to a vision board party, not this New Year's Eve, but the last one. And I put on my vision board that I wanted a job in the writers, like a Writers Guild writing job. And then we went on strike for, you know, 5 months. So I'm like, I don't think, you know what, maybe vision boards are my thing. I don't know. I kind of wandered into stand up and just was like, I want to try it. And then I stayed. And then I wandered into TV writing because, my first job, I was on a show called Tough Crowd and it had a bunch of stand-ups in it. And I was like, oh, I want to be around all those people, you know? And, so that got me into TV writing and then that turned into its own thing. And, I've always sort of stumbled into things. I'm not a great planner and, that'll probably hurt me when I'm 70. But I don't know. It's just not my way. I'm like, even right now, I am doing a lot of clipping of stand up and, you know, doing the captioning and the editing and all that stuff. And it's technical. Mm. You have to pay attention to it. And I can't tell you how tired I get from just editing my own stand up. It hurts my brain. It's not what I'm meant to do. I'm meant to be in the shower thinking of jokes. Like, I need to live in a country that would support that.
So,
and go ahead. Sorry.
What underlies those efforts then?
Well, I mean, I feel like if I don't, I won't ever work. Like, the industry's changing so quickly, at least here in the States. And like, if you know, they look at your follower count they used to look at TV credits and how they could promote you. And now they're like, let's look at your follower account. Let's see how many people you can bring to the club. And half the time I'm like, are you the comedy club even posting a calendar online, or are we supposed to do everything? It really shifted very quickly. I don't know. We're still in the middle of, or still at the beginning of this, I think. It feels like it's getting worse and worse every couple months. You know, like I've asked clubs, you know, when they have like a TikToker who's new to stand up, you know, like sell out a whole week of shows in a way that I, a 35-year veteran, could not, right? And I'm like, are the shows good? And they're okay, but the audience doesn't mind. So the audience is okay with what they've seen because they wanted to see the famous person. Well, what do we want from stand-up now? Do you have to get laughs? are we just changing everything about stand-up where you don't really, you know, you don't have to, I don't know. I guess the job is to please the audience. And if they're happy that they just saw a famous person, but maybe would they come back to comedy again? If they think that's what stand-up comedy is, you know, if this is their first time in a comedy club because they saw their funny friend from TikTok, and then they thought the show was okay, you know, would they go see a non-famous, did they become comedy fans, or are they still just fans of famous people? I don't know. You know, I obviously have a lot of time in the day to ponder these things. But it's weird. It's a really weird thing that is is happening to the stand-up club business now that I don't know how it's going to end.
Mm. Laurie, failure is a key part of success. Do you have a favorite failure?
Oh, I mean, I'm living some failures right now. I don't know that they're my favorites, but maybe they will be later. I mean, so I wrote for Conan O'Brien for 11 years. So you think that would be like, that's a good thing on a resume. And he kept me for 11 years, right? So I'm probably a pretty good joke writer. Have not been able to get another writing job. And I have done packets for so many other shows. And I'm just like, oh, am I not good? And I don't note it? Or, you know, I don't know. It's a lot of failures recently. So I don't know that they're my favorites, because usually a favorite failure ends up in a success. So maybe I'll be, I can come back on this podcast in a couple of years and be like, oh, I didn't know this incredible thing I was headed for when I was failing at all these other things. But currently I'm sitting in quite I'm treading water in a lake, a full lake of failure, and hoping I get to shore soon.
What do you tell yourself when you're in the midst of what feels like failure?
Just keep going. Like, you know, after I did so many packets, which are little, like basically auditions for getting a writing job on a late night show, with to no success. And then the strike happened, and then there was this feeling when the strike ended, oh, okay, now we're all going to kick into gear, the studios, everyone's they're so far behind, but it hasn't happened like that. And they aren't picking up many pilots, and a lot of really experienced, like, you know, I was also working on a pilot for a long time, and a lot of really experienced writers aren't working like sitcom writers. I'm sorry. I was going to try to transition to that, and then they're not working, and I'm not even an experienced sitcom writer. So I thought, the only thing I know I'm still good at is stand up. So I'm just going to go all in on stand up for this year, I guess. I'm not going to worry about coming up with another spec or do another packet. I'm just going to, you know, clip the hell out of my bits, my stand up. I don't know if bits is a euphemism there. Clip the heck out of my stand-up and all that kind of stuff, and see if I can get enough of a following via social media to kind of pack out clubs and make money that way. I mean, I don't know what else to do besides die, you know.
It feels like, and I say this from a writing perspective, in most industries, working very hard gets you places, like it gets you promoted, it gets you a different job, you know, along that type of career path. There's a real cause and effect to it. But in the creative realm, that relationship doesn't necessarily exist. It can be very disheartening.
Yeah. And also, like, I don't know what it's like to start stand up now. I mean, it's really hard, right? It's weird. Like Netflix either is getting stuff from people that have been famous for a long time, so they know that they'll, you know, attract the same people that know who they are, or they're following people with a bunch of TikTok followers, right? You know, there's no one, like, it doesn't feel like there's any part of the business that's like, I see talent in this person. We're going to get them early and give them a half hour. And then in 3 years, we'll give them an hour and nurture that along, you know? And when I started, it was like you were the MC, you went all over the country making not much money, but you got your stage time in. Then you were the feature, you're doing like a half hour a night, you're making a little bit more money. And then you were the headliner and you're making the most money of the three. And along the way, you would get little TV credits, you know, so when they would introduce you, I've been on the Tonight Show, been on da da da. And that was sort of the ladder. And then ultimately, like, you get a sitcom if you were really lucky, right? Or you get a writing job. But at some point, you go into TV somehow. And now it's really, the ladder has been dismantled. And that's, in a way, that's good, because so few people could climb up that ladder that way. But in the other way, it's like, well, what do we do? Like, I have a friend who was just kind of like, you know, working class comic, hustling, and then four clips went viral. Four. And then now he's selling out like six shows at a club in the week. And it's nothing you can predict. That I think that's what's like so crazy making. It's like, and it's like, you don't know what's going to go viral and why. So you have to just keep putting stuff out there and going, maybe this is it, or maybe there's some cumulative effect that will, I don't even know. I'm guessing as much as anybody else is, you know?
Yeah. Also what goes viral, like in terms of TikTok and Instagram and that sort of stuff, is such short form stuff. Like a reel is 90 seconds, whereas an entire comedy set is a much long, I mean, even if it's a half hour or something like that, it's so, it's not just adding up however many the sums work, 90 second bits, like it's actually creating a narrative. It's such a more difficult beast. So to go from that 90 second thing into the half hour is like, that's a big jump.
Well, it's more the, well, yeah, I guess if you're starting on TikTok, but if you're like a road comic and you're trying to condense things to 90 seconds, that's also, that's my hell, you know, or you know, there's a US comic named Kyle Kinane, and he's like a really great storyteller, but his stuff's 5 minutes minimum is the shortest Kyle Kinane thing. And you can't squish it to 90 seconds without losing like so much of the context and stuff that, you know, it's tough. It's, and then it's like, all right, well then make, you know, reveal something else about yourself to the audience. I was trying to do some, I can't even get my kid to do, like I have a kid, right? And there are a lot of comics that are like featuring their families in clips. And that's part of the thing, right? And that's part of their, why they have a huge audience, which is fine. I mean, that's a separate worry to me, bringing your kids into things, but whatever, everyone's going to do their own thing. And I have been really protective of my son. You know, I talk about it on stage, but no one knows his name and, you know, whatever. And he, you know, you wouldn't meet him and go, oh, you're from her act. Like, we don't even look alike. I mean, there's so many things separating us that, you know, he would have to announce that he's my child if he ever wanted to, but I was trying to get him to just like pretend to be in a clip that he would refuse to be with me. And he wouldn't even do that. Like, come on. How am I going to get anything here? I don't know. It's, we're being asked to like, here's the thing, like for stand-up, you know, what I do on stage, that's what I want to give the audience. That's that, whatever that personality is and whatever I say, that's what I want you to have. And what I'm being told now is, no, they want the other part. They want the part, they want to know about your actual life. They want to see your kids. They want to see how you live and your normal day. They want all of that. And that will get people to come to your show, where you can actually give them what you have trained and wanted to give them. It's really not what I want.
Yeah. It's a difficult space. Laurie, we are almost at the end. I just have a few quick fire questions so you can pass on anyone. Some might resonate more than others. The first is, what's the best thing you've bought for less than $100 in the past 6 months?
Oh my gosh. I got this portable kettle. Christella Alonso, who's a comic here, posted about it like 2 years ago on Twitter. And I was like, oh, I got to get one of those things. And I just got it. And it's got like a silicone cup, I guess, whatever that part where you pour the water into. So it squishes down and it weighs almost nothing. And I bring it on the road with me and I boil water. And then I can have a cup of noodles in a hotel room. Apparently you can make eggs. I can have my own coffee. I don't have to use the coffee maker in the hotel that I know somebody jerked off on. Like,
oh God, it is don't a game say that. No.
Do you want to know or don't you want to know?
Oh, I know now.
You don't want to.
That's true. Listen, that's true.
I will hook you up. I'll send you a link. It's really cheap. And then you'll be fine. You can bring it with you. And you always can have hot water in a hotel room. And it was like, at least at the most, it was $40. It was under 40 though.
Amazing. I love that. Next question. What does the first 60 minutes of your day look like?
All right. Let's see. There's at least a 10-minute snooze alarm kind of thing where I get myself 10 more minutes. I get up, I start toast for my son. He's 17, by the way, but I treat him like a 6-year-old. start his breakfast. I let the dog out. I have my coffee. I go on Twitter. Maybe I start writing. I try to do 3 pages a day in a journal, based off of my old, years old application of The Artist's Way. I don't know if you remember that.
I love
book,
The Artist's Way. I was going to say, is it stream of consciousness, yeah, or is it like, are you thinking?
Yeah, it is.
As you
it's a lot of it. A lot of it is just keep writing. Like I write that sentence over and over again, because I'll write and then I start daydreaming, or I'll think of things to do. And then what should be a 15 minute just blurt is like, can take an hour. And then I drive my son to school, and then I walk the dog, and then I'm done with the morning activities where other mammals need me. And then I go, what do I need to do? Sometimes I'm packing. Sometimes, like the last month and a half, I've been doing a lot of podcasts and promoting my comedy special. Or today, I went to a coffee house and spent like 3 hours on what will be like a 1 minute clip, because it's crowd work. And I had to edit, you know, you had to, it started out as a 60 minute set and I had to take it down to a minute, and that takes so long. So yeah, so that was today, and the days go by quickly.
Last question. Do you have a quote or mantra that resonates with you?
I mean, it's not really a quote. It's not a good mantra. I just keep going. That's not really, I don't even think anyone ever said, it's just like a, I think that came off an apron maybe, or a coffee mug, or somebody's, I don't know, just keep going. Like, I don't know what else to do. It's more like a helplessness, I guess. But no, I don't. I should have a mantra. I should, and I will. The next time we talk, I'm gonna. Now I know what you're gonna ask me, and I will have so many incredible quotes that you'll be very impressed by me.
That's amazing. Just keep going. It is the perfect note to end on, really. Lori Kilmartin, thank you so much for your insight and energy today. You can find show notes for this episode of The Next Step at katherinecollette.com. You can get in touch via that website or via Instagram at katherinecolletteWriter.